This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. It's good to have you with us because it's February 14th. Now, my youngest is 8 today. And from the day she was born, we always thought it was so special to welcome new life on Valentine's Day, a day set aside for some special appreciation for our loved ones, which is also part of what made what happened 4 years ago today even more painful.
17 people lost their lives, 12 people within the building.
We heard the police coming down the hallway, banging on doors.
I thought I was going to die.
17, you know, casualties, 17 people that aren't going to return to their families. And to me, that's totally unacceptable.
For an entire generation of young people, this day is marred by the memory of what happened at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, on February 14th, 2018.
Just pray for this city, pray for this school, the parents, the folks that lost their lives. It's a horrific, horrific day.
After the initial shock of the deadly shooting, attention turned to the message being delivered with painful clarity by the Parkland survivors.
All these people should be at home grieving, but instead we are up here standing together because if all our government and president can do is send thoughts and prayers, then it's time for victims to be the change that we need to see.
It felt like maybe this could represent an actual turning point on gun violence legislation. If only lawmakers would listen to the voices of the students who saw their classmates murdered.
Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA in the future?
No, the answer to the question is that people buy into my agenda.
And the parents who lost everything that day.
It doesn't make sense. Fix it. Should have been one school shooting and we should have fixed it. And I'm pissed because my daughter I'm not going to see again.
And some local legislators were paying attention. According to Stateline, 50 laws were passed restricting access to guns between February and August of 2018. 14 of the states where those laws were passed had Republican governors. But at the federal level, little changed. In the first year of the Biden administration, with Democrats in control of Congress, no significant federal legislation on guns was passed. Data compiled by the gun safety advocacy organization Every Town for Gun Safety shows that nationwide, there were more than 200 incidents of gunfire on school grounds in 2021. It led to 49 deaths and over 100 injuries. Now, all this hour, we're going to be reflecting on what has changed and what has stayed distressingly the same in the aftermath of Parkland and other school shootings. And we wanted to start by examining the psychological and emotional toll of these shootings, both on the survivors and really on all of us, but especially on our young people who go to class every day, aware of the risks of gun violence in schools.
I'm Laura Wilson. I'm an associate professor at the University of Mary Washington.
I'm Dave Cullen. I'm the author of the books Columbine and Parkland, Birth of a Movement.
I asked Dave, what is different in the aftermath of Parkland compared to Columbine?
You know, with Columbine, it was just completely blindsided them. So many of them the day after talked about it being like a movie because that's all they could conceive of. They never saw this coming. So that was the additional, really, shock and horror, like this whole new thing to be afraid of in your life and to be terrified of. Like, oh, it's not safe to go to school. Whereas the Parkland kids, you know, some of them told me they were expecting it. And all kids to some degree now, like they know the monsters are real. And so it's still horrible when it does, but it's not also the blindsiding and just so many of the Columbine kids went into the numb phase of PTSD, which a lot of the experts I talked to said was really unusual, that high level, because it was so staggering to them.
I can remember so distinctly Columbine, every frame of every piece of film that we saw for weeks afterward. I can remember that sense, almost like a post 9/11 sense of having entered into a new part of our nation, and thinking things won't be the same after this. And that as horrifying as each one has been, there's somehow been almost like a diminishing shock to finding our schools as spaces of mass shootings.
After the one in Texas, Sutherland Springs, I think, I was with some friends who are also journalists. And a good friend of mine in the back seat was on her phone and said, oh, there's been another mass shooting. I was like, oh, God, where? And she said, Texas. And I said, oh, and I changed the subject. I couldn't just go there again. I couldn't just like, I just can't handle this again.
Professor Wilson, tell me what we know about the effects on survivors in the immediate aftermath of a mass shooting.
You know, to start, we know that exposure level is associated with the risk for post-trauma difficulties. You know, so what that means is that people who were physically injured or felt like their life was in danger are going to be at higher risk for long-term issues than an issue who maybe is more removed from the incident. And so some of the more common reactions are things like recurrent thoughts about the shooting or nightmares or feeling on edge, whereas other people might experience depression or anxiety or substance abuse. And in the hours or days after a mass shooting, almost every person who was directly exposed to the event is going to experience some level of difficulty. But the good news is that people are actually really resilient. And over time, we see most people's symptoms dissipate. But of course, we need to keep in mind that there is a subset of people that experience lingering difficulties. The impact of a mass shooting isn't just isolated to the people who were directly exposed. It definitely will kind of trickle out into the larger community. And so what we see, you know, in the field of clinical psychology is that the community's level of well-being definitely decreases. And with the level of media of exposure that we get to these types of incidents, the community really is all of us. You know, we see, you know, individuals live tweeting when they're sheltering in place and we're hearing the fear, you know, in hearing about their experiences. And it gives us a level of exposure that, you know, decades ago we didn't have. And so we certainly do see that the impact is much larger than just those directly physically impacted in the moment.
Is this different than other kinds of traumas? So in part, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about, you know, the experience of 9/11 or even of an interpersonal trauma that might occur as a result of abuse or violence. Is there something unique at all about the mass shooting experience and maybe particularly in the long term about that kind of sense of vulnerability?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge difference. You know, just as one example, the rates of chronic mental health difficulties after a mass shooting are much higher when we compare them to natural disasters like hurricanes. Now, that isn't to downplay, you know, the mental health impact of other forms of trauma. You know, those certainly are significant, you know, in and of themselves. But instead, I think it actually highlights how substantial the psychological toll of mass shootings is. And the reason that is mass shootings are a result of a person or people trying to inflict as much harm, pain, and death on a group of people as possible. And so that form of violence is associated with more significant changes in thoughts. And so it's those thoughts driving the mental health impact. And so mass shootings are going to disrupt how people think about the world or think about other people or themselves. And so it's that interpersonal malicious nature of the incident that's going to amplify the psychological consequences in survivors and the impacted community.
So Dave, as you were talking earlier, you were saying, you know, the Columbine kids or the Parkland kids. Now, the Parkland young people are still largely young people, but the Columbine kids aren't kids anymore. And I'm wondering what we know about them as adults.
You know, in the first year or two, I was most concerned about the kids who had gone through it and who seemed so much shattered. And I wasn't paying as much attention perhaps to the adults, but they didn't seem as kind of crushed by it. I'm talking about parents, teachers, and, you know, so forth. Those two sort of lines in the graph like crossed at some point, maybe 5-8 years out, where the kids by and large got past it. And actually by the 5th anniversary, I know that like I talked to a lot of the kids, like the news stories for the 5th year anniversary started to be about them getting past it. And then I talked to some kids much later, like Val Schnur, 10 years out, I was talking to her and she said she started avoiding the media 5 years out because she wasn't doing better and felt kind of embarrassed. So there was another contingent of people who still took much longer, but by the 10 years she was. And really, you know, the kids would tell me that like in their own encounters with each other, when they would come back for like reunions or whatever, see each other again, I totally like, seven, eight, 9 year, most of them had sort of moved on. And it was really telling to them that they no longer even brought it up. And like, they actually didn't want to talk about it anymore. They were just done talking about it.
I'm wondering, Professor Wilson, what is the actual psychological process that isn't necessarily about our conscious minds thinking forward to it, but that triggers us to re-experience some aspects of that trauma?
I think there's a bit of a misconception that recovery after a trauma is linear, meaning that, you know, with every hour, every day, every couple of weeks, you should be improving, you know, whatever that means for that person, and that any improvements are then maintained and you only get better. But in actuality, what we see is that symptoms come and go, new ones develop, you know, you might get kind of new sources of support. And so some symptoms might go away. And, you know, one of the biggest kind of triggers, you know, to use that word, is the anniversary of the trauma. And so, you know, that is absolutely, you know, something that we see after a mass shooting, that throughout the year, you know, in years to come, there will be moments where the individual's functioning is probably going to experience, you know, some changes. And so it's important that survivors know that, because they often experience some shame around that, thinking that, you know, well, I was doing better, you know, what have I done wrong? And so I think that that's, you know, first of all, just important for people to realize. And I think it's important for the larger community to know that, that you really need to be patient with individuals while they're figuring out what their new normal is. And I think that that's also an important thing to realize, is that these individuals will never go back to their pre-shooting self, that they're going to need to figure out what life looks like for them moving forward. And that goes for any form of trauma. You're never, you know, truly who you were before it happened. And so it's figuring out how to navigate it, you know, in the future.
Based on you having gotten to know these young folks and what you've learned in writing the books, what is it communities could do, and in fact, the broader nation, to better support survivors of mass shootings?
The one that I always come back to is, don't rush the healing. I think that the single best thing we could do is just be aware of how the things you're saying might be perceived. Believe me, they are drowning in advice. They don't want your, quote, help, and which all they see is pushing them to, like, why don't you get past this already?
Yeah, I mean, really, I agree. I think the number one word needs to be patient. What I always hear from impacted communities is they're surprised how quickly everybody else moves on. I mean, in the hours and days after a mass shooting, you know, they're at the forefront of media attention. But typically that's when they want privacy. They want to grieve. They want to kind of pause and figure out what happened. They don't want the attention. It's in the weeks, the months, and the years later, when they've had a time to kind of pause and catch their breath, that they probably do want to have a dialogue and would appreciate some support then. And by then, people have moved on to the next, you know, major news story. So, I mean, to me, it's patience and just making sure that we're in it for the long run to support them in whatever they need.
Dave Cullen is the author of the books Columbine and Parkland. And Laura Wilson is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Mary Washington and editor of the Wiley Handbook of the Psychology of Mass Shootings.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.